Hola, comrades. This is just an announcement that we've finished transcribing 10 plus hours of anti-fascist and anti-racist interviews. These range from a Black Lives Matter activist in Brooklyn to a migrant rights advocate in New Zealand, among other writers and activists. Thanks to our generous donors, we were able to pay transcribers for over half of these, transcribing the remaining in-house. You can find a master post of the transcripts pinned to the top of our blog at jetpack.zoob.net. Solidarity, good night, and good luck.
Rockets on our backs, and we're on the smooth moving sidewalks. Hey, where's my jetpack?
Kia ora, hello comrades. Welcome to Where's My Jetpack, a politics and pop culture podcast with sci-fi and socialist leanings. I'm Ani White, and today we're interviewing trade unionist, socialist, and migrant rights advocate Gail Ilmalgoda. Earlier this year, we interviewed Gail on migrant and refugee rights in the age of COVID, and now we're talking about the Tanki revival and how rubbish it is. Welcome to the show.
Kia ora, thank you, Ani.
Good to have you. So, to start off, a bit of historical context. 10 years ago, you could argue Stalinists were irrelevant in the West.
Yes, absolutely. At the time, I was in a third camp international socialist organization, and you were in the multi-tendency workers' party, and the leadership of my organization, the ISO, took great delight in accusing the workers' party and pretty much any radical socialist organization of being Stalinists, and it was very polemical. It was pretty much a mainstay of my experience of radical politics, at least in the early times. And at the time, of course, it didn't have much substance to it, and it was, as I said, it was pretty much just a polemical device to denounce supposedly rival organizations.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of had a distant Maoist lineage, but honestly, we were probably a lot more Trotskyist.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the two of us, along with a lot of the younger comrades of both organizations, we developed a stronger relationship in spite of the leadership of both organizations. You had this interesting generational split where the leadership were very polemical about each other, but the younger comrades developed more of a relationship. At the time, I argued Stalinism was irrelevant in the 21st century, and that was a pretty common perspective in the Workers' Party at the time, that Stalinism just wasn't worth opposing. You know, it was bad, but it didn't really matter that much. But whether or not we were right at the time, and, you know, I'm not sure about that, whether or not we were right at the time, that has changed with this kind of strange neo-Tanki revival through the internet. So there are a lot more Stalinists around in the movement now than there were 10 years ago.
Mm.
So it used to be kind of, you know, Joe down the road and his one-person Communist Party, that would be the Stalinists, whereas now there's a lot more young people who actually believe in it. So
yeah.
I kind of joked that this is not the socialist revival we wanted, but the socialist revival we deserved. And
and
the new features of this kind of Stalinist revival are meme culture and the mingling with strange forms of identity politics, I think, where people sort of argue the only way to be anti-racist is to support states like Iran or what have you. And in some ways, this revival doesn't sit well with the history of Stalinism, which has been pretty gender normative and, as we're going to argue, pretty racist. But, you know, like, I know this is something the right likes to say, but honestly, I think a lot of Stalinists wouldn't fare well in Stalinist states. Neo-Tankism is dismissed as just a kind of internet phenomenon, and it's true there are no mass Stalinist parties in the West, particularly in the Anglosphere, but then the alt-right were previously just an internet phenomenon as well. And internet politics are a part of real world politics. Digital media is one of the main contexts for communication. And the concept of a tanky, it's not actually new. It's seen as an internet meme, but it actually goes back to the crushing of the Hungarian Prague democracy movement by liberal Russian tanks. And the term tanky can be found in Communist Party of Great Britain, CPGB documents from decades ago. So it's not so much new as it's been revived along with other zombies of the 20th century. And tanky, just to define it, refers broadly to supporting so-called actually existing socialist states such as China, and also so-called anti-imperialist states like Iran. It's a kind of degeneration of socialist politics that prioritizes solidarity with states over solidarity with people. And the central claim of tanky politics is it's the best way of defending socialism in the face of imperialism. It's probably the most coherent theoretical defense they have. But in practice, that empties out all of the radical content of socialism. So as seen at the inception of Stalinist politics in the 30s, when Stalin purged, executed, or exiled most remaining members of the 1917 Central Committee. So it sort of defends and wins while emptying out all of the radical content of socialism. We're going to be talking more about one of the central claims of contemporary tankism, which is that it's the politics of the third world, unlike anarchy or Trotskyism. And we argue that's actually erasing struggles in the majority world. So to go into one example, Gail's going to talk about the history of Trotskyism in Sri Lanka.
Yes, you made a very good point, Annie. Many tankies, many socialists wouldn't fare well in the so-called actually existing states or the anti-imperialist states that they support. And I think what I hope to sort of convey through giving a very brief overview of the Lanka Sama Samaja Party, which is the first Trotskyist organization in Sri Lanka, in fact it was the first political party in Sri Lanka, is that, well, when you say things like that, you're implicitly accepting that people of color, people who are not in the Anglosphere, their version of liberation or their version of human dignity or their version of a worker's struggle should be limited and should be abridged. And essentially they should, and this is not of course explicitly stated, but essentially they should accept brutal regimes, they should accept torture, they should accept curtailment of their liberties and freedoms, and they should accept inequality, because the best that they can hope for is a supposedly anti-imperialist regime to rule over them. And I mean, I think hopefully at the end of this show people will be able to sort of consider why that is obviously racist, and why it actually, as you said, erases the vibrant struggle of people in the third world, or working class people in the third world, I should say more explicitly, because they are every bit as capable of contesting their political, social, and economic rights as working class people anywhere else in the world, and they should not have to settle for any less than what people would expect in the Anglosphere. Just getting into this history of Trotskyism in Sri Lanka, first of all, I should say it's quite a personally significant history for me, because my family, members of my family, have been very conspicuous supporters of the Lanka Sama Samaja Party, or the Trotskyist Party, that was instrumental in the struggle for independence against imperialist Britain in Sri Lanka. In fact, I think I may have told you this, Annie, but one of my relatives was a member of the Lanka Sama Samaja Party, very prominent, and some reactionaries took revenge upon the family by plastering my great-grandparents' tombs, or I should say tarring my great-grandparents' tombs, with the symbol of a hammer and sickle. So that tar has been chipped off, but if you visit my great-grandparents' tombs even today, you will see the outline of a hammer and sickle, and that is, in my mind, forever a sort of testament to absolutely something to be proud of in my family history. With that personal sort of anecdote, I'll sort of get into some of the actual details of the Trotskyist movement in Sri Lanka. So as I said, Trotskyism in Sri Lanka started in the 30s and in the 40s, and it had its formation during the anti-imperialist struggle of the Sri Lankan working class, and the attempts of the Sri Lankan working class to rid themselves of colonial Britain. And if you know anything about Sri Lankan politics today, what should stick out to anyone who studies the Lanka Sama Samaja Party is the complete rejection of, at least in the early days, of communal and ethnic chauvinism. This was an organization of workers that was committed to uniting Tamil and Sinhalese and migrant Tamil workers in the struggle against imperialism. And they really earned their stripes from the early 30s onwards when they were organizing the Lanka Tea Estate Workers. I think the name of the union was the Lanka Estate Workers Union, in a series of sort of mass strikes in the 30s and 40s that were designed to sort of break the back of the colonial economy. And the interesting thing about the workers in those tea plantations were they were overwhelmingly migrant origin Tamil workers. And the struggles that the Lanka Sama Samaja Party was leading them to were working class struggles that prioritized the interests of working class people, regardless of whether they were Sinhalese or Tamil. There was a famous strike in 1933, one of the first strikes that they organized, one of the largest mills, spinning mills, in Sri Lanka at the time. So mostly women, two-thirds of the workers, I think 1,500 workers, it was quite a big mill in Sri Lanka at the time. Two-thirds of them were Tamils, about a third of them were Sinhalese. And the Lanka Sama Samaja Party led an extremely high profile and a successful strike, one of their earliest strikes. And so this ethnic solidarity thing has always been a hallmark of genuine workers' struggle in Sri Lanka. Another hallmark of the struggle led by the Lanka Sama Samaja Party was staunch anti-imperialism. And, you know, the 1930s and the 1940s was actually a time when many communist parties around the world were telling workers to prioritize the Allied struggle against Germany and the Axis powers, and to put aside the more immediate, you know, issues with the capitalist imperialist regimes that they lived under. But the Sri Lankan Trotskyists, they made a very clear stance and said that they would not prioritize the interests of Britain over the interests of Sri Lankan workers. And as far as they were concerned, Sri Lanka was an occupied state, it was an occupied nation. The Sinhalese and Tamil workers were in no way going to put their struggle for independence on hold while Britain pursued its war. And this was a very radical and a very staunch anti-imperialist stance that they took. They, of course, stood very firmly against fascism, but they were also very particular to say that the Sri Lankan workers were an oppressed people and they could not be called upon to shed blood for the benefit of their imperialist overlords. So because of this, Sri Lanka has a very interesting history during World War II. Sri Lanka was, I understand, the only part of the Commonwealth where rationing wasn't vigorously imposed, because the agitation of the Lanka Sama Samaja Party was such that the British imperialists were afraid to do anything to upset the Sri Lankan populace, the Sri Lankan working class. So, I mean, a beautiful illustration of the power that these Trotskyists were able to harness in the working class of Sri Lanka. The only troop sort of mutiny on the Allied side during World War II were a group of Sri Lankan workers who were deployed, not workers, I should say soldiers. There was very little, no conscription during World War II, and there was a small contingent of Sri Lankan soldiers sent to the Cocos Islands in Australia, and they mutinied and attempted to dubiously hand over the island to Japanese imperialist powers. But it was certainly, those soldiers cited the agitation of the Lanka Sama Samaja Party as a reason for their refusal to cooperate with the imperialist agendas, right? So I think that's another sort of hallmark of the Lanka Sama Samaja Party. After the 1947 general election, so after Sri Lanka attained independence in 1947, there was a general election, and the Lanka Sama Samaja Party was effectively, it was in fact, the main opposition party. And this was a tremendous political gain for the Sri Lankan working class, both Sinhalese and Tamil. Now, the thing about Sri Lanka is, as you might know, the British, when they left the country, they made sure that as much power remained in the hands of sort of anglicized Sinhalese and Tamil elites, right? And these elites were desperately trying to appeal to ethnic Sinhalese elites in particular, desperately trying to appeal to ethnic chauvinism in order to relate to the people they were ruling, you know? Like, you know, we're wealthy and we run everything, but at least we're Sinhalese, essentially. The tried and true sort of strategy of using racism to divide the working class. But the Lanka Sama Samaja Party was a powerful and effective counter to that. And in the 50s and 60s, they continued with wave after wave of strike, and again, very, very successfully organizing Tamil workers and Sinhalese workers together. And I think that's essentially what the the reactionary forces in Sri Lankan politics essentially started to target was this unity. So their game was, of course, to sow ethnic hatred. And they did that essentially by, one of the main things they did was they passed the Act of Constitution in 1948. So this was essentially, ostensibly, it was to establish a constitution of an independent Sri Lanka, or Ceylon as it was called then. But the effect of it was to disenfranchise thousands and thousands of Tamil workers who had lived in Sri Lanka for generations and who worked on those plantations that the Lankar Sama Samaja Party organized. And essentially it was an attempt to break the back of the working class struggle, or the most radical section of the working class that was based on these colonial plantations. And the other thing that happened was in 1956, the Sinhalese chauvinists in power, they passed the Sinhala Only Act, which made Sinhalese the only official language in Sri Lanka, and essentially targeted at that time 30% of the population that spoke Tamil, right? Marginalized them. And the Lankar Sama Samaja Party, again, it was very much calculated to destroy that unity of the working class that the Lankar Sama Samaja Party was able to command. And in fact, they came out very staunchly and strongly in opposition to that. In fact, there was a famous speech given by a Sri Lankan Trotskyist, I think his name was N.M. Pereira, and he said, it's quite a long speech, I won't read out the whole thing, but he said, the question is, do we want one independent Ceylon, or do we want two? Ceylon must necessarily be united and single, or will it be two bleeding halves of the Ceylon, which can be gobbled up by every ravaging imperialist monster that may happen to range the Indian Ocean. So, in no uncertain terms, this organization was able to call out communal politics and say that it was detrimental to the working class. I think this is a thing that tankies should understand. Brown people, people in the third world, they are able to figure out what's best for them. Their political traditions are rich, they're vibrant, their traditions of struggle are rich and vibrant, they are contested spaces. Right? So I think it's a huge mistake to look at them and say, no, all that they're fit for is repression and ethnic chauvinism and perhaps a broadly anti-imperialist state to rule over them. I think that's extremely, at the very least, it's extremely narrow-minded. I think the Sri Lankan Trotskyists are an object lesson of how Stalinism and, you know, statism isn't the organic choice of the working class in the third world. It doesn't have to be, it isn't. And of course, you know, these other traditions have been stifled, you know, have been attacked and stifled. And, you know, I think genuine solidarity with workers in the third world would mean that we should reach out to those other traditions and understand those traditions and understand the nuances instead of making assumptions about what's good for workers in the third world. For someone from my generation of Sri Lankan people, the idea that there was a time when that kind of solidarity between Sinhalese and Tamil workers existed just seemed so foreign, so alien, and so distant. But, you know, it did exist, and it was destroyed by intervention that was reactionary intervention. I think that's something that is a real testament to the achievement of the Trotskyists in Sri Lanka. And even today, because of their struggle against British imperialism, Sri Lanka is officially called the Democratic Socialist Republic of Sri Lanka. That's what it's called on paper. Obviously, it's not a Democratic Socialist Republic, but because of the tremendous hand that Trotskyists had in founding independent Sri Lanka, that's what it's called. And till this day, Sri Lanka has free education all the way up to university. It has free healthcare. It has one of the highest literacy rates in the world because it's supposedly was founded on democratic socialist values. That is owed to the Sri Lankan Trotskyists, and something that Sri Lankan Trotskyists should be very proud of.
Thanks for that, Dale. That was very informative and interesting. I mean, I've read bits and pieces, but that laid it out and covered a lot of stuff I wasn't aware of. I understand they made an electoral alliance that didn't work out. Do you have any comments on that?
This was in the 70s. They made an electoral alliance, I believe, with the SLFP, which had very strong sort of reactionary elements. And also in the 70s, they had, and this is the other thing, they had a lot of splits within the Trotskyist communist movement, right? Many of them became more associated with Moscow and with Stalinism, right? And I think those splits were really detrimental. But that, of course, you know, that's not organic. That was an intervention from the outside. It wasn't an organic sort of development within the class politics of Sri Lanka. In the 1970s, as a result of those splits, I would say, and also as a result of them trying to sort of accommodate, you know, trying to sort of find an accommodation with some of these chauvinist bourgeois parties, they lost all their seats. So in the general election, and I think it was 1970, I'm not sure, I think it may have been 1974, they essentially lost all their seats. And, you know, ever since, they haven't been able to regain because the communalist politics of the bourgeoisie gained greater and greater ascendancy.
Yeah, and I mean, the 70s was a pretty bad time for a lot of the left internationally. Also, yeah, I've had some interest in the Fourth International, which backed that party, and that, you know, part of their account is about the collapse of that alliance. But certainly, I mean, Stalinist parties made those sorts of alliances very early on, like right from the 30s. I mean, we can probably grant that Sri Lanka was a relatively unusual case in terms of the scale of the Trotskyist movement. So in a lot of cases, either in the West or in the majority world, Stalinist parties were the largest, and the Trotskyist parties, you know, I mean, Trotskyism began as a breakaway from that. So, you know, it was hard to re-establish the same kind of mass base that Stalinism had developed at that time, which they ultimately squandered. But even if we acknowledge that the Stalinist parties have generally been the largest historically, that certainly doesn't mean they're the only radical currents in the majority world. And making that claim, as we've said, it homogenizes majority world struggle. I think what you say about that in a way there's kind of one socialism for us, the core countries, and another socialism for people in the majority world that are forms of repression we wouldn't accept here, we can accept there. I mean, when I say we, I am referring to tankies. But anyway, and another reason Trotskyists and anarchists didn't get a foothold is that Stalinists outright massacred them in a lot of cases. So,
absolutely.
You know, it can be hard.
Like in Vietnam, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Or also, yeah, in parts of Latin America, Peru and all that. So, I mean, another country whose radical history is erased by these kinds of Stalinist claims is the Philippines, where I think really the international voice of the left for the Philippines is generally the Communist Party, even though that's far from the only current of, you know, radical or progressive or socialist politics in the Philippines. And it's certainly true that the Communist Party of the Philippines, the CPP, has had a significant impact on Filipino radical history. But the claim that Maoism is the radical current of the Philippines, sort of the only radical current, and that other currents such as Trotskyism are just a kind of a foreign imposition, they actually erase the work of many Filipino activists and organizers. As I'm going to talk about, I paid a visit to the Philippines for a socialist seminar where, you know, I learned about some amazing work that people were doing who were from a breakaway group from the CPP. And the CPP has, as I said, a near monopoly on Western accounts, Western kind of communist accounts of the Philippines, even though there are other groups that have broken with it or challenged it or were never aligned with it, are rarely acknowledged in English language accounts. And this gets particularly problematic when you have something like the CPP endorsing a fascist like Duterte and having their international mouthpieces echo that, and then 6 months later claim it never happened. So for a concrete account of the CPP's relationship with Duterte, I'd recommend the work of Anthony Scalise. We'll link a YouTube lecture by him in the description. And one thing I've found is it's pretty much gaslighting. So people will claim that they never supported Duterte and that's a slander. And you can go back and find, you know, explicitly they're campaigning for Duterte to be elected. You know, they're at rallies alongside him. But now it reaches a point of denial where you do genuinely wonder if you're crazy or you're exaggerating. And the useful thing about Scalise's work is he actually documents that alliance. So it's like, oh yeah, that did actually happen. They were actually supporting Duterte. And one of the reasons Volga anti-imperialists initially supported Duterte was because he made gestures towards opposing the US military, which don't seem to have really followed through. But opposing the US doesn't have to mean supporting terrible figures like Duterte or Putin, Xi Jinping, you know, Assad. And, I mean, there's another aspect to it which I can understand, which is that the CPP was in peace negotiations with Duterte. But, you know, you don't actually have to campaign for the person you're in peace negotiations with. Like, that's not really how that works. It was a decision they made to support him that goes beyond being in peace negotiations. You know, there's a lot of peace negotiations where the two sides will certainly not endorse the other side. But often when you point out the counter-revolutionary violence of these various strongman figures, so less so Duterte now because it's been acknowledged that he's terrible, but say with, you know, Xi Jinping or Assad, people respond that the US does bad things, to which we kind of respond, well, yeah, obviously the US does bad things, US imperialism is bad. So we have protested outside the Russian embassy, for example, and been asked, why aren't you protesting outside the US embassy? And, you know, we have. So, you know, you can oppose the US and also oppose Duterte even when he makes moves towards challenging them. And I think that's a situation of whoever wins, we lose. So rather than supporting geopolitical camps, we support democracy movements regardless of what side of the geopolitical line they're on. So getting back to the Philippines, there's a bit of a tangent, but in June 2019, I visited the Philippines for the Asia-Pacific Regional Seminar of the International Institute for Research and Education, or IIRE, an organization which is broadly affiliated with the Fifth International and the Revolutionary Workers' Party of Mindanao, RPMN. And as I've mentioned on the podcast before, this seminar was easily the most stimulating socialist educational event I've ever attended, and I've attended quite a lot. So with comrades from Fourth International sections or sort of semi-affiliated organizations, because some are directly in the Fourth International, some are more sort of at arm's length, but with comrades from every continent but Antarctica, really. So you had, you know, comrades from Brazil, from Pakistan, from Japan, and the sharing of experiences and ideas was very stimulating. And the style of education was genuinely participatory. So, for example, you know, you could have people discussing the different situations for gender and sexuality struggles in different countries, where, for example, in the Philippines, and this does actually include the Communist Party, but also other sections of the left, have been pretty good in terms of sort of LGBT struggles. So, you know, we're conducting gay marriages before the state was. Whereas, you know, in Pakistan, there were comrades there who were saying, you know, we want to support these struggles, but we don't really know about them. Comrades in the Philippines seminar did emphasize generally in my experience that for the RPMN, the political is primary over the military struggle, whereas for the CPP, the military is primary over the political. So it's for the CPP, it's primarily a guerrilla war, and that is how they conceive of their strategy, whereas for the Mindanao section, primary is the struggle around issues like peasants' rights, workers' rights, LGBT rights, and their military section is only used for self-defense. So it's only used to defend their section and not as their sort of primary strategic sort of orientation. For the remainder, I'm going to quote another piece in full outlining the history of the RPMM. And as usual, you can find the link to the full article in the description. So, quote, a country plundered of its natural resources, its tropical forests decimated, simmering armed conflicts, a corrupt state carrying a debt of billions, incapable and unwilling to erase the daily suffering and hunger of its citizens, millions forced to work abroad. The Philippines is a textbook example of the effects of neoliberal globalization. For years, the Revolutionary Workers' Party of Mindanao and its predecessors have been trying to organize the poor and oppressed of Mindanao, the large island in the south of the Philippines archipelago, to struggle for change. The party, since 2003 a section of the Fourth International, has its roots in the Maoist Communist Party of the Philippines. And in the 1970s and 80s, the CPP and its allies in the National Democratic Movement had complete hegemony over the left in the Philippines. The fall of the corrupt regime of Ferdinand Marcos in 1986, however, turned out to be a defeat and victory for the CPP. The organization that made such great sacrifices to wear down the dictatorship found itself isolated from the mass movement because of its insistence on the primary role of armed struggle in the countryside and the boycott of elections, which, by the way, a side note, they've since reversed that position. They do participate in elections now without at any point saying that they were wrong. So they purged people for advocating for a position and then have since adopted that perspective, which is very typical Stalinist party stuff. But returning to the article, members of the CPP, or the old party as it is referred to by former members, still cling to the interpretation of Maoism it started out with in the 1960s. For them, the current regime of president, okay, this is the previous president, Arroyo, is not really different from that of Marcos. They see the country as still, quote, semi-feudal and semi-colonial, unquote. Certainly, the official democracy is a sham. Since 2001, more than 1,000 social justice and human rights activists have been murdered or disappeared. Nobody has been convicted for these crimes, even though it is an open secret that the murderers and torturers are found to be in the military, the police, and the many private armies. At least after the monopoly on power by Marcos and his cronies, competition between factions of the ruling elite has opened up some political space, something the National Democrats also implicitly admit by participating in their elections with their own electoral formations. Since the fall of Marcos, the Philippines has become more and more integrated into the global economy. Big landlords are still powerful, but the export of raw materials and cheap labour have become more important, and the role of capital in agriculture has increased. A growing part of the population lives in cities. The RPMM and its predecessors had been in contact with the Fourth International since the 1990s, trying to orient themselves in the new situation. Harry Kabongranla, once a CPP leader in Mindanao and now a leading RPMM activist, explains, quote, "We consider our struggle to be a fight against imperialism that must be part of an international struggle of progressive and socialist organizations," close quote. His party sees a need to fight for basic democratic rights and now gives more attention to legal mass campaigns. For the RPMM, democracy and self-determination are integral parts of the struggle for revolutionary change. Mass movements are the key. Arms are necessary to protect movements and activists, but do not guarantee victory. Members of the party's armed wing, the Revolutionary People's Army, secure party gatherings in the mountains of Mindanao and protect villages sympathetic to the party from criminals and private armies. Other tasks involve training self-defense groups of indigenous people that resist the destruction of their native lands by mining companies and also helping peasants with harvesting and planting. In 2005, the RPMM negotiated a ceasefire with the national government. In return, the party demanded that the government install running water and electricity for dozens of isolated, impoverished villages in Mindanao. Tragically, the most recent clashes involving RPA fighters were with the New People's Army of the CPP. The CPP has denounced every left group that does not follow the National Democratic Framework as traitors and counter-revolutionaries. Numerous left-wing activists, including several RPMM members, have been murdered by the Maoists. Mindanao is a troubled part of the country. Since the 1970s, the National Army has been fighting the CPP and also separatist Islamic movements, a conflict that sometimes became a full-scale war. Anti-war campaigning and relief work for the war victims are priorities for socialists in Mindanao. The work shows a very practical interpretation of anti-imperialism and the struggle against poverty, and foreign and Philippine capital. The RPMM is now a growing organisation of some 2,500 members, and for the first time is expanding its work beyond Mindanao, all the time undergoing deep changes. For example, women's liberation is an integral element in all the work, and the party has organised a lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender group. So if you want to learn more about the Philippines section of the Fourth International, we'll link their English language website in the description. But again, groups like the RPMM are raised when people claim that Maoism is the radical politics of the Third World and that other currents are either non-existent or somehow imposed. And the irony is that the Fourth International is often treated as a joke because its Western sections are small, but their more significant sections in the majority world have been forgotten and ignored.
It's really interesting, Annie, some of the things that you mentioned in your spiel about the Philippines. I think the issue, you know, with Tankyism and with Stalinism is a rejection of genuine internationalism. And I think replacing genuine internationalism or international workers' struggle with this dogmatic idea that every society or every country has a form of socialism that's tailor-made for it, or a form of anti-imperialism that's tailor-made for it, for its, you know, organic qualities of the people who live there, which is all, you know, completely reductionist and essentialist nonsense, you know? The way this plays out can be quite dangerous, that's the thing. When you do see movements or people in the majority world contesting their rights and actually claiming that, you know, they don't want to live under any form of repression, functioning as the revolutionary class that they are, many tankies, because of their dogmatic position about anti-imperialism or statism, they'll actually aggressively oppose those movements. They will not see them for what they are, which is, you know, the natural sort of resistance of the mass of the working class. I think in Wellington, we have had an issue with some tankies, or one tankie in particular, who was very, very pro-China and believed that that was the genuinely socialist position. And in New Zealand, this person would obviously support all sorts of progressive political positions on gender equality, on queer activism, all that kind of thing. But when it came to activists in China contesting, you know, a regime that denies them these things, they immediately took the side of the repressive regime, because dogmatically, China is an anti-imperialist so-called existing socialist state. So, I mean, this person during the Hong Kong protests actually surveilled, took pictures of Hong Kong protesters or students from Hong Kong who were protesting in New Zealand, and actually presumably handed them over to the Chinese embassy here. This is not only completely misguided, it is actually dangerous. You have someone here who's so committed to this position that China is an actually existing socialist state and that has to be protected at all costs, even from its own working class, that they're actually willing to expose the families of these students who are protesting to danger.
I saw people respond that this person was a LAPA, and that was their response to this whole situation, and say we shouldn't care about it, which I think was pretty appalling, because whether or not they were actually acting as a cop, in other words, whether or not they actually handed those pictures over, it was obviously an intimidation tactic, and as you say, playing on people's fears of things happening to their family or being deported, what have you. This is behaving as a cop, essentially. So that's the point where Tankism goes from laughing into being a cop, really.
It's not laughing at all. If only it was that innocuous. It's extremely dangerous and completely disconnected from a genuine perspective on class struggle. And I mean, I think you mentioned also in what you were saying earlier about sort of Assadism. Again, I see a lot of parallels between what people say about Sri Lanka and the kind of society that Sri Lanka is, mired in sort of ethnic conflict and, you know, in need of a strong man to keep all these crazy people in the hot place together. People on the left say that about Assad. They say, well, you know, yes, you know, like there is sectarianism and, you know, yes, he does, you know, he does stoke, you know, some of the worst elements of sectarianism in society. But, you know, he's all they have. That's all that we have to principally sort of support him at all costs. I mean, that is complete rubbish. And that is frankly insulting to, you know, the Syrian people who have expressed their desire for freedom in very unequivocal ways. You know, they want to live in a society that is not a dictatorship. They want to live in a democracy where everyone is equal. These currents exist but tankies are incapable of actually recognizing these currents for what they are because of their dogmatic stance. And I think also this has always been a problem with Stalinism. As you said, the origin of the word tanky, people who supported the crushing of pro-democracy activism in Hungary with tanks were called tankies. Well, nowadays you have tankies doing such absurd, abhorrent things as denying the genocide and the ethnic cleansing of the Uyghurs in East Turkmenistan by the Chinese state. This is surely, in our generation, one of the most tragic and despicable positions that the radical left could take, you know, ignoring the call for Uyghur self-determination and actually completely denying what is actually happening to this group in China. We're not going to be taken seriously on the radical left if this is the kind of thing that is expressed. I think the radical left has a strong duty to call it out and to actually acknowledge the oppression that's going on and to show solidarity with oppressed people everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, with the Uyghur struggle as well as outright denial, you also see arguments that would not be accepted when it comes to the repression in the West. So you see people saying this is radical Islamic terrorists and that makes it okay to police an entire community. And that certainly, for these people, and correctly, would not be accepted if it was the Australian or the US state saying it, that, well, because they're radical Muslims, therefore criminalizing an entire community is acceptable. I like to say fascists are consistently reactionary. Tankies are inconsistently reactionary. They're like reactionary on some questions, usually when it comes to really the third world or anything seen to oppose the US, and are not so reactionary when it comes to really their own struggles, essentially. And tankies oppose prisons in the West but support them in China. They accuse people of being cops when they act like cops. They accuse people of racism while erasing the struggles of actual people of colour. And one of the claims of tankies is that criticism of the Chinese state is orientalist or xenophobic. And granted, there is a history of xenophobia and yellow peril discourse in Australasia and elsewhere. So we've recently seen this bizarre war between Australia and China, where my kind of take on that is whoever wins, we lose. But the solution is a class line, so it's not romanticizing the Chinese state as a way of countering xenophobia. So in the case of China, we back Chinese workers, not the Chinese state or capital, just as we would anywhere. So tens of thousands of Chinese workers have gone on strike in recent years. According to China Labor Bulletin, strikes increased 13-fold over 5 years. So that's where our sympathy lies. It's not orientalist to support the same struggles internationally as we would support here. And recently we've seen drum beating from the Australian and US government against China. Neither side supports democracy or self-determination. So another way to put this is neither Washington nor Beijing, but international socialism. And I'm sure this line of criticism, as we've found often in New Zealand, and you see it on social media, it'll upset not just tankies, but those who are kind of obsessed with left unity and say, you know, we disagree with the tankies, but you can't criticize them. But unity needs a principled basis. It needs a common goal. And I'm not sure I share a common goal with those who support capital and the state against workers. So with this critique in mind, what is to be done?
I'll put it this way. It's not xenophobic to support workers in China who are joining trade unions, or workers in China who are taking to the streets to demand the rights and freedoms that workers in Australia or New Zealand have and have fought for. That is not xenophobia. It's xenophobic to say that these people need to accept anything less because they live in China or because they're of Chinese origin. That's the issue. That's where the racism lies. As you said very eloquently, we would not tolerate the kind of repression that the Chinese government metes out to people living in China if it were meted out against the working class in Australia or New Zealand or the UK or America. And I think that's the simple point. And if you realize that, we can begin to sort of build solidarity with genuine German workers' movements around the world, and this is based on internationalism, the understanding that the workers' struggle is an international struggle. It is a struggle of solidarity between workers in every state and every country. On that basis, every socialist on a principled political basis should support democracy movements everywhere, should support anti-racism everywhere, and should celebrate in and support and reach out to workers' self-organization instead of fetishizing states and leaders. I think if you actually look at the history of class struggle in the Third World without taking a reductionist and essentialist view, which is Orientalist, right? That is the Orientalist thing to do. If you actually look at them, you'll see that they are capable, they are more than capable of producing their own organic struggles and of pursuing their rights fully as working class people. Organic leaders may emerge from time to time, but as is always the case, leaders should be accountable to the class that elevates them. They should be accountable to the working class, and the movement of the working class is what must always come first. This is true anywhere. This is true in the West. This is true in Russia. This is true in Australia. It's true in New Zealand. It's true in China. It's true in Sri Lanka. And I think if anyone wants to sort of delve into this a bit more, it's fascinating. The history of the majority world of struggles is truly fascinating. I've spoken a little bit about Sri Lanka, but you know, you can eat on Sri Lanka alone. There's huge amounts of information out there about the Sri Lankan Trotskyists and Sri Lankan socialism in general. And I would encourage anyone to do their own study into it. Promise you, you won't find it boring at all.
And I mean, a key recent example of this kind of struggle for self-determination is the transnational uprising of 2011 across the Middle East and North Africa, and even inspiring the Occupy movement and the imperialist core, as well as obviously Indignados in Spain. And the legacy of 2011 is a living legacy and will keep reverberating the way 1917 or 1968 do. And again, the fight for democracy is fundamental, and it's an inspiring moment when it breaks out after decades of repression and passivity. Yet, tankies choose what struggles they'll support based on geopolitical camps, on what's supposedly bad for the US and good for Russia or China, rather than paying attention to struggles on the ground. So one way I put it is solidarity with people, not with states. And the Syrian revolution is a key example of this sort of betrayal. So the Communist Party in Syria supported the dictator Assad against the popular uprising, and tankies internationally have echoed that perspective. This was really a struggle for democracy, and if you look into material on the outbreak of 2011, it was non-sectarian, it was democratic across different communities. So unfortunately, since then, it's kind of been polarized, where it's seen as a Sunni struggle and not, you know, as an Alawi struggle or a struggle of, you know, minorities or Christians or Shiites. But, you know, if you look at in 2011, they had slogans like Sunnis and Alawis are one, Syria is one. It was an anti-sectarian and democratic uprising. And one of the real victories of the Assad regime has been to essentially turn it into a sectarian struggle. So, you know, they released Salafists from prison at the same time as they were imprisoning democracy activists, for example. And the fact that it's now perceived as a struggle between Assad and ISIS, when ISIS only entered the struggle a few years later in 2014, it was really an occupying force coming from Iraq. The fact that it now has been seen as a struggle between Assad and ISIS, I think in itself is a real victory for Assad, that the democratic nature of the 2011 uprising has been completely forgotten and erased, and I really think we need to bring up that history and remind people of it. One claim we hear whenever, you know, a perspective is advanced, really whenever a non-tanky perspective is advanced on these questions, is that international politics shouldn't matter for us in places like New Zealand. But this is kind of messed up on many levels. So in the case of the Syrian struggle, Syrian diaspora is everywhere. It's the largest refugee community in a generation, at least. So it affects everyone. The idea that we would basically say that the struggles of the largest refugee community in the world don't really matter, because if we talk about them, we might divide the left. I just think shows really poor priorities. And we have Russian embassies on the soil of most countries, just like we had US embassies. International politics are interconnected. There's a claim some people make that the left doesn't matter, so it has no international influence. For one thing, that doesn't mean we can't show practical solidarity. So, for example, there's a radio channel, Radio Fresh, in Idlib. It's a revolutionary radio station that opposes the Assad regime, but they've also been attacked by some of the Islamists for having women as hosts. So they're a principled democratic group, and you know, there's a fundraising campaign for that. You wouldn't really get support from that from a lot of the left groups because of the position on Syria. So the point is, even when we're small, we can show practical solidarity for something like that. We can not donate, we can promote it. And I mean, if we ever aim to be relevant, if we're not aiming to just be a small milieu of students or what have you, then we're kind of going to have to work these questions out. So you have people who talk of developing a mass socialist party without taking any positions on international questions, which is kind of a nonsense. And ultimately, this anti-internationalism, the line that international questions don't matter and don't need to be debated, it's an unprincipled talking point masking either terrible politics or a fetish for unity for the sake of unity rather than unity for a common goal. And as we've said, it's also just denying and erasing actual struggles in the majority world. And we can learn a lot from least recent living revolutions. So you said we should delve into the history, and it's absolutely true, but even just delving into what's easily available on struggles in the last few years can be fascinating. And you see a lot of leftists just not doing that, not learning about something like Syria. So we don't just learn from Russia in 1917, we can learn from Syria 2011. And sure, not all of the lessons from the Syrian revolution are positive. For example, we have to reckon with the sectarian hijacking, but that's equally true of Russia 1917 or any other real revolution. There are positive lessons and negative lessons of any revolution, and there are tensions and contradictions in any revolution. But in my view, if you're a radical, progressive, leftist, whatever you want to call yourself, socialist, you should be reading the work of Syrian revolutionaries in particular in this context, because I think that's some really important work. So in that vein, I'm just going to suggest a short reading list. So three essential texts on the Syrian revolution, because obviously I've barely scratched the surface and there's really a lot that people should know about that struggle. So there's a book called Burning Country, Syrians and Revolution and War by Leila Al-Shami and Robin Yasek Saab. This book is based on extensive interviews with Syrian revolutionaries, and it offers a sort of useful on-the-ground narrative of the various stages of the conflict. Another one, The Impossible Revolution, Making Sense of the Syrian Tragedy, which is by Yasin Al-Haris Saleh. Whereas Burning Country kind of operates at the ground level with these ground-level interviews, The Impossible Revolution offers more of a macro-level analysis. It's a collection of essays by Yasin Al-Haris Saleh, starting in 2011 during the revolution, and with essays through to, I think, 2014. And Saleh is an intellectual who was imprisoned by the Assad regime for 10 years for his membership in a Communist Party breakaway, which emphasized the struggle for democracy. And nowadays, he's known as the conscience of the revolution. And these essays go into depth on the class character of Syrian society. They have a kind of a breakdown of the classes in Syrian society, which is honestly much more perceptive than a lot of left writing I've read in some time, in terms of actually concretely trying to understand how class works in a given society. And talks about the basis of the revolution. So one of his arguments is that two of the key elements were the kind of dispossessed Sunni majority, but also the urban kind of intellectuals and that. But he goes into various aspects of this. He also goes into the degeneration into sectarianism, and the last chapter is about the most insightful thing I've read on sectarianism, where he talks about it as kind of Islamic nihilism, and that as you come to see the world essentially as corrupted, this kind of nihilism is a kind of a withdrawal from the world. I mean, it's really something that's happened in a lot of places that have just been demolished, whether it's by US bombs or, in this case, primarily Assad and Russia's bombs. In any case, there's a kind of traumatized withdrawal from the world, which is associated with this kind of Islamic nihilism. So, yeah, anyway, that's a book that's very much worth reading and very insightful. There's a shorter article that was put up by Spectre magazine and also associated with the Alliance of MENA Socialists, the Alliance of Middle East and North Africa Socialists. So this was written by Frida Afari and Tamara Al-Khateb, and it's called What is Holding Back the Formation of a Global Prison Abolitionist Movement to Fight COVID-19 Capitalism? So, quote, in the Middle East and North Africa region, Syria has the highest number of political prisoners, roughly 100,000 people. A letter signed by 43 human rights groups calls for the immediate release of all prisoners from detention centers and jails and prisons inside Syria. There is a tendency among some on the global left to ignore or defend authoritarian rulers who claim to be against US imperialism. This selective anti-imperialism refuses to defend political prisoners in countries such as Syria, Iran, Russia, China, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, even if they oppose all imperialist powers and religious fundamentalism. Of the over 100,000 political prisoners in the brutal Assad regime's dungeons, the majority are not jihadists. They're youth, Kurdish, labor, and feminist activists who dared to participate in the uprising against the Assad regime in 2011 and after. The millions of Syrian refugees who are being bombed by the Assad regime and their Russian and Iranian allies suffer in refugee camps in the region, close quote. So again, it's this opposing prisons in the minority world or the West, what have you, and supporting or denying the existence of prisons in the majority world. And as I say, I think there's a lot to learn from the Syrian revolution and a lot that we'll be learning for a long time unless people shut their minds off on the basis that, you know, Assad is an opponent of US imperialism, which he really isn't. One thing I found really funny was a Trotskyist who was saying, I celebrate every time Assad soldiers kill US soldiers, and the only possible response was, they're not doing that. There is not a ground war between Assad and the US. So this was a fiction that he had in mind, maybe a slogan borrowed from Vietnam or something, and he'd obviously just not paid attention to the basics of the actual situation. So yeah, if you've got those kind of mental blockers, you know, you're obviously not going to learn. Yeah, are there any other points you want to make?
No, I mean, that's a really brilliant reading list, Ali. And I mean, I think we have, as you said, a lot to learn from the 2011 Arab Spring, because it was an object lesson as to why the politics of Stalinists is wrong when it's applied to the Third World. It was an object lesson in how the working class in the Middle East, which has constantly been maligned in the West as being backward, sectarian, unable to understand democracy, when they came out in mass and basically said things like, you know, Sunnis and Alawis are one, Copts and Muslims are one in Egypt, you know, these were the slogans that were coming organically from the working class. And I think it is really sad if people cannot see the class for what it is and what it's capable of. So I think socialists need to understand and need to keep their focus on class struggle and not give in to narrow-minded and racist dogmas.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it comes down to a lack of faith in the class and sort of giving up on that and saying states are the safeguard. And I mean, the two of us were involved in Syria Solidarity organizing in Whangarei, Wellington, and we organized, for example, a demonstration at the Russian embassy, and you had the Syrian community coming out, and young men sort of took over the mic and were chanting Syrian Arabic chants, and it was really nice to just let the kind of these, you know, young Syrian men just take over the event and sort of graffiti the Russian embassy and everything. But yeah, we were criticized for protesting out the Russian embassy, and as mentioned earlier, it was like, why don't you protest outside the US embassy? To which the response is, we have many times. So yeah, it's a matter of consistent solidarity that we stand with oppressed and exploited people everywhere. Thanks for coming on the show, Gael.
Thank you, Annie. It's been a real pleasure.
And solidarity, comrades. Good night and good luck.
Saturday morning, I take a turn at the skillet. I burn some eggs, boil coffee, drink a cup, then refill it. I read some pages of the paper, mostly look at the pictures. There's a drip at the faucet, so I fumble with the fixture. We take our own showers, wash our own hair, make our own beds, push in our own chairs. I thought all this stuff would get done for me. A robot mows the lawn while I sit under a tree. I thought we'd control wind and rain, cure all sickness, eliminate pain. I wanted mind-reading gadgets to cater to my wishes. Wanted self-cleaning kitchens and non-sticking dishes. Where's the end of war, freedom from disease? Where's the milk and honey you see the shining sea? And where are the crime-free cities, rockets on our backs, and we're on the smooth-moving sidewalks. Hey, where's my jet? Breakfast on the table at 6:45. Rocket to the moon and race right back to my holograph and my new jet backpack. Yeah. I was gonna watch your dreams on a flush-mounted giant plasma flat screen. We were gonna live forever with a wish and a pill and the pull of a lever. Heaven on earth in a God-free zone, where we all get along and no one's alone. A paradise of plenty where nobody lacks. We all flying around with our own jet packs. Where's the end of war, freedom from disease? Where's the milk and honey you see the shining sea? How come there's rats in my kitchen, monkeys on my back? Where are all the monorails and sky trams? Yeah. Where is my jet? In a God-free zone where we all get along and no one's alone. A paradise of plenty where nobody lacks. We all flying around with our own jet packs.